You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to Gangland Wire. I'm here in the studio, and we have, via the magic of Skype, our good friend Cam Robinson from Chicago. Welcome, Cam. It's good to have you back.
Glad to be back, Gary. I really enjoy it.
All right, good. Well, Cam has helped me a lot in doing this research because, folks, I am working on another documentary film about the Kansas City crime family, just in real specific about the Carl and Nick Zavella, who were the brothers who really ran the family in Kansas City, and their war with four other brothers, Carl, Nick, Joe, and Mike Spiro. And it was a war to the death, and I've been working on that like crazy after I did my little Bonnie and Clyde tour through the South. As if you're listening to this or you're watching this on, and listening to it on Skype, I mean on YouTube, why you will see the Bonnie and Clyde tour through the South with my good friend, retired canine sergeant Kate Kozel. We hit all the Bonnie and Clyde sites. I do want to thank somebody. I want to thank Michael McCollum for making a nice little donation. I really appreciate it. And don't forget to hit me up on your Venmo app. Buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer. You can always go to my PayPal, $25 or more, and you get a free copy of my DVD. And if you get on up there, and like my friend Mr. McCollum's going to get, he's going to get a book and a movie. So, you know, there'll be some rewards if you give us a little money to help keep this thing going and pay the hosting fees and the Freedom of Information Act request fees and those kinds of things. You know, Cam, I don't know if you've done much of that or not. I just did one. I got a whole case file. And I shudder to think it's a story I'm really interested in, and it cost me $265. But that was a whole case file from a trial that happened in another city. So it was, but there's a ton of good information in there.
Yeah, they give you a little bit, enough to whet your appetite, but when you really start getting into it, it does get expensive.
It gets expensive. I've got lots of times you can get 50 pages for free, I believe. And I've done that several times. Have you done that?
Yeah, I have done it a couple times, and it seems like they give you just the beginning stuff and maybe the most redacted stuff. You want to get stuff?
Yeah, really, you'll have half a page redacted.
That's right.
That's a killer, isn't it? God, or there'll be a name redacted. It's like, damn, I wish I knew that name. Come on.
You know, the one guy, make the one connection.
Yeah, really. But, you know, it's still some pretty good information. And I like it that you can get it digitally, too. You don't have to get a whole pile of papers in the mail. They'll send me a CD-ROM with it already down on digitally. And you know, I'm using those in this documentary I'm using those to make a picture of an individual piece of paper, an individual report. Just one page of it has some interesting information. Now I take that and I pull certain text out of it, and I can make it, you know, expand on the screen whenever I get my documentary going. So we'll be talking about Nick Sparrow, the oldest Sparrow brother, getting a job with a truck line. And here's an interesting little story. He set up a load of liquor to be stolen. And then he turned around, went to his bosses and said, hey, you know, I noticed we lost this whole load of liquor. He said, I can get it back for you. And they said, well, you know, that'd be great. So he got it back for them. And then as a reward, you know, then they trusted him and they raised him on up to be a supervisor. And he got in where he could get, you know, more information about all upcoming loads. And guess what happened after that?
Give him the keys of the kingdom, huh?
Yeah, he knew when and where everything was coming and going and what it was. And And all of a sudden, their thefts start going up, and he wasn't getting any of those back for him. So,
I can't help you with those. They're above my pay grade. I wish I could. You know, I'm not in good with the guys anymore. They don't trust management anymore. I can't help you.
You know, and by the end, they had to pay him some money to get him to quit. He was in the union, and they paid him a bunch of money just so he'd quit.
Yeah, just break his contract, yeah. We'll pay you to break your Teamsters contract.
Yeah, nothing like that ever happened in Chicago, did it, with a union Teamsters guy?
No, absolutely not. No, labor is totally above the board here in Chicago. We don't. There's never been any corruption here with the Teamsters here in Chicago. Absolutely not. No.
I seem to remember that Harry Alleman killed that Billy Logan dude because he was a dispatcher at a truck line and he was refusing to parcel out some information to certain people. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was what.
Alan Dorfman was a straight shooter too.
Oh yeah, I got a little soundbite from Alan Dorfman. It says, you got to be in Las Vegas. You can't maneuver any fucking money unless you're in gambling."
just like the farmer, Roy, your guy, the
Roy Williams.
Roy Williams, yeah. Yeah, he was another one. Yeah, the Teamsters were totally totally straight laced since the days of Hoffa and Dave Beck.
It's amazing, yeah, Dave Beck. It's amazing. Jimmy Hoffa. That's another quote. Is Morris Schenker out of St. Louis was being threatened by Joey Lombardo, and Schenker says, "You know, I did business with Hoffa." I only did business with Hoffa, and Hoffa said you went in on it, but I only did business with Hoffa. So, because Lombardo was trying to shake him down because he had gotten a big Teamsters loan. Now Hoffa's gone, and he's not kicking back regularly like he's supposed to out of his, I think it was the Aladdin Casino that he had. I can't remember for sure. So, yeah, you get in bed with those guys, you ain't never going to let you out, ever. And that Teamsters union got in bed with them back in the day. It started right after the war here in Kansas City. All right, folks, today we're going to talk about Raymond L.S. Patriarca of Providence, Rhode Island, and the, what do you call that? Do you call that the New England crime family, the Providence, Rhode Island crime family? How do you describe that?
They called it the office. The Patriarchas called themselves the office. You know, these different groups had different names, you know, like Detroit was called the Partnership. Chicago was obviously the Outfit. New England, the Patriarchas called themselves the Office. Buffalo called themselves the Arm. Different groups had their own names for what they were. I don't know if they thought it added some respectability or if they just wanted to differentiate themselves. But the Patriarchas called themselves the Office.
You know, in Kansas City, they called themselves the Click, which is a little-known name. It never really hit the news, but they called themselves, if you knew somebody that was involved, they would say they called themselves the Click.
Huh. I'll add that to my list. Make it sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, really. Hardly anybody knows that, so they won't believe you anyhow. But I only know it because I interviewed an old-time mobster when he's on his deathbed. And he kept talking about the Click. Finally, I said, "What do you mean the Click?" He said, "You know, the boys, the guys, you know what I mean." He wouldn't say anymore, but that's what he meant was the mob.
They kept their secrets. Said,
yeah. So, you know, you made a point to me as we were discussing this. You sent me some documents on this. I thought it was really interesting about the Patriarca family stands alone. They were not really under anybody else. You know, Kansas City really and Milwaukee are really under Chicago in many ways. Like Nick Savella kicked up money that he didn't have to Joey Iuppa in Chicago out of his own personal casino scheme. So we were really under them. And some of these other crime families, I believe Philadelphia was under Carlo, the Gambino family?
Yeah, Angelo Bruno was sort of nominated for power under the Gambinos, and originally they ran Atlantic City, but, you know, once the five families wanted in, Philadelphia couldn't hang on, so Nicky Scarfo kind of gave it up, and, you know, so Philadelphia couldn't hang on to anything that New York wanted, and, you know, Cleveland gave up to the Genovese family. They were dependent on them, and they were repped on the commission by the Genovese. You see some of the farther out families like the Marcellos. They kind of did their own thing, but they were so far away from anybody. The Traficantes and the Marcellos, they didn't really have to deal with anybody because they were isolated. But the patriarchs were in the middle of the action right there in New England between Boston and Rhode Island and into Connecticut as we'll talk about in a future show, and they ran their own program. They had a few dealings with the Genovese in Western Massachusetts, but they had their own dealings, and if anybody wanted to move into Rhode Island or move into Boston, they had to get permission. They couldn't operate on patriarchal territory without getting permission from Jerry Angiulo in Rhode Island from Raymond Patriarca. They were not dependent on any of the other families. They definitely stood their own ground, and they had a lot of men, and they commanded the same respect from New York as they would give to one another, as the five families would give to each other.
Interesting. You know, I got it. Brings to mind a question: is Boston and Providence, Rhode Island, now geographically they're real close?
Yeah.
As we call it, as I've heard it called in the media, I believe, is the New England mob or New England crime family. So Angiulo, and I read that, you know, he was like the boss in Boston for a long time, but he was actually an underboss in the Patriarca family. Is that what you're saying?
Originally, New England was split up among a bunch of different groups. There were little Sicilian groups all over the place. When Raymond Patriarca took over in the early 50s, around 54, he really set about gathering everybody under a single group. He was sort of the Iron Fist, and he gathered every group together. He sent guys to Boston, and he took over. There was an older guy named Joey Lombardo, just like the guy in Chicago, but he pretty much ran the whole area. When Patriarca took over, he got this guy, Joey Lombardo's blessing, and he really, really got everybody's under the same roof. He took over for an older guy, Morello, who had fled to Sicily. He got Boston under his control, and he gathered everybody in the area between the two states under one moniker, and he ran it as one group. But he recognized that Boston was sort of its own location. It was a big city. He stayed in a little place in Providence, Rhode Island. Federal Hill was there. Little Italy. He ran a little coin laundry called the Coin-O-Matic, and so he set it up so his underboss would be in charge of Boston, but would recognize Raymond Patriarca as the boss. Originally, it was Harry Tamaleo, and then Jerry Angiulo came along. He was running a gambling empire, a couple million a year, but he was not a made guy. He was getting every mob guy was coming up to Angiulo and extorting money off of him. So he gave Patriarca $50,000 and promised him an extra $100 a year if Patriarca would make him a made guy, so these other guys would leave him alone. So Patriarca made him. Jerry Angiulo never had to kill anybody or any you know, the old school way of getting your bones. And so Jerry Angiulo became a made guy by buying his way in. And he eventually was given Boston. He was making more money than anybody else. So Patriarca, it was kind of a brilliant move, and showed sort of the planning a lot of these old guys have. You know, like you've shown with Nick Civella, that sort of that Machiavellian thinking that we've talked about. He had Boston under their own umbrella, but kicking up to him because he held the real power. But having the underboss in Boston, and having himself stationed in Providence as the head, he really was able to control that much territory, And that gave him the strength to sort of keep New York out and also keep the Irish gangs in line. That was a big thing in Boston, but Patriarch was able to control them by having so much territory and keeping it divided that way.
Interesting. So now the Irish gangs in Boston, that had to be a big deal. Of course, Whitey Bulger and the Winter Hill Gang and all that, and they had some Italians involved with them. That was it, Stephen the Rifleman Fleming. He was Italian, but. They kind of morphed across lines a little bit off ethnic lines, but I don't think the office probably did not go across ethnic lines. Somehow they kept the power over the Irish guys. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, guys. You know, the Irish guys had a lot of wars. They had some wars in the 50s, and then later on in the late 60s. Guys like Stephen Fleming and John Martirano, the butcher of, I can't remember what he was a butcher of. He was a damn butcher of something. He killed a hell of a lot of people.
He killed a bunch of people. There's a 60 Minutes interview of him. I've seen it on Facebook, YouTube. So
he was good friends with Ed Bradley. They went to college together.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Maybe it was high school. I don't know if Martirano was a college. I don't know if he was a...
Probably high school.
Shit, hell, it was probably elementary school. I don't know.
He was the undereducated or white male, right? They used to talk about
as the Oxford jacket sort, but Martirano and Fleming had a lot of mob connections. They were the children of Italian immigrants, so they could mix with that crowd.
Yeah.
And that sort of gave the Irish mobs the sort of little bit of clout, and that really helped out Whitey Bulger and his rise, gave him a little bit of information into Angiulo. But yeah, the Irish mobs definitely kicked up to the Italians. They understood. And you know, Whitey Bulger even said you didn't use the name Angiulo, and Kevin Weeks has commented on this too. You didn't throw around the name Angiulo, you didn't say their names. You understood that the Italians were the real power. They didn't mess with the Irish per se, but they did get their cut. But there weren't too many problems between them as long as they maintained their separate identities, and they did do some cross business, and like I said, Fleming and Martirano had connections, but yeah, they maintained pretty separate identities.
So in some of your research, I was noticing that they really were kind of heavy into porn back in the day, back in what would this been like the late 70s and early 80s when there was still some money in it. Now it's before the internet, pre-internet. Internet took all the money out of porn. I know a kid here in Kansas City that he made about 20 grand in 1 month doing some porn stuff. And he was from a good family. I knew his dad really well, and he came to me for some advice. He said, yeah, he said, I've got out of it. He said, it's just too dirty, but that's how much money you can make in this. It's amazing how much money is in porn. But the mob had it locked down before the internet hit, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. The Gambinos had total control of the porn. Robert DiBernardo, he ran porn from New York to L.A. He was in charge of it all. He ran not what you think of as sort of normal porn. When you DeMeo, Roy DeMeo, was known for the alternative porn, we'll call it. I think he, I've read some stuff where he was distributing some bestiality stuff, and Paul Castellano didn't like that, and Gaggi, who was the capo, he wasn't too keen on it, but they were making so much money that they would turn a blind eye to some of the strange shit, because Roy DeMeo was not discerning in how he made his money. I mean, he'd do whatever to turn a buck and made a lot of money. So the Gambinos, whatever end of the porn spectrum you found wherever your interest lie, whether it was sort of the more tame stuff or if you were, I don't know, way the hell out there, the Gambinos had you covered. And they reached out. DiBernardo had some connections. The Patriarchas did allow a porn distributor, a guy named Kenneth Guarino, to be their Gambino porn representative throughout New England. And he was doing, he was busted in 83, I think it was, and it was millions of dollars worth of porn that he was, $3 million a year porn ring in Rhode Island. I mean, before the internet, we know how big the internet porn ring has gotten now, but before that took off, there were movie theaters, there were magazines, there were all manner of things, and it was big business. I mean, porn was a huge money maker.
Yeah, they had the peep shows and the dirty movie theaters, all kinds of different books and magazines,
and all those guys paid the mob. If you know that's all Times Square was back in the day, and if you right. ran one of those places, you know, the mob was getting their cut. They ran it. They owned it.
Yeah.
If you were making porn, if you were distributing, if you were making movies, if you were showing movies, if you were selling books, the mob wanted their cut. You know, here in Chicago, that was a big thing. Frank Calabrese talked about going around and making collections for his father at all the area porn shops. I think Red Womet, who you talked to, he had a porn shop, didn't he? Or he was
he was making big money, and Frank Suisse was, you know, collecting a piece of that. You couldn't, and he said, you know, you couldn't operate without kicking up to the outfit.
Yeah.
If you were anywhere around all the gray, you know, really all gray market businesses, or over into black market businesses, whether it be gambling, pornography, prostitution, I'm trying to think of some others. We even had a gray market drug thing going here in Kansas City where they were overstating the number of nursing home beds that several nursing homes they had control of actually had, and then they could order all kinds of pharmaceuticals at a big discount because they were going to a nursing home or some kind of a deal in the federal statutes that you can do that, and they can't charge you full price for what would normally be to a nursing home, and they get a big discount, and then they were turning around and shipping them out to an independent pharmacies and selling them. So any gray area business, you know, the mob's going to get a piece of it.
Yeah, Chip Fratiano put together a faulty dentistry ring for the Teamsters, and submitting false claims to dentistry and putting together some connected dentists, and they would submit false claims to the Teamsters Insurance Fund and give a kickback to the dentist for submitting false claims, and then collect the money for the false dentistry work that had gone through. I mean, these guys are awful damn. They believe in free market capitalism.
They do. You got to be right on that. And the amount of money is amazing. So they had there was some kind of a problem with the was it the Genovese family or was it Gambino family?
It was
in New York
during these years.
The Genoveses ran. They did have a branch in Western Pennsylvania in Springfield, Massachusetts. It was run by a guy named Sam Cafari, and he had a lieutenant, Carlo Mastrototaro. Say that five times fast.
That's a tongue twister, there, man.
And Mastrototaro split a porn shop with Jerry Angiulo, and it was the only porn shop in Worcester, Massachusetts, and it was run by these two brothers, Joseph and Tommy Palladino, and they owed Jerry Angiulo about $20,000 in gambling debts, and they ran book out of the store. So Mastrototaro hooks up. He's a Genovese guy. He hooks up with this Kenneth Guarino, who runs porn for the Gambinos. And they get together. Guarino says, hey, my capo, a guy named DiBernardo, the Gambino porn guy, will distribute extra porn to us, and we can set up a second shop in Worcester and split the business. So Master Totaro, he says, well, then I'll have part in two different porn businesses, so I'll get double the money I'm getting from Jerry Angiulo. So now we've got Sam Cafari, who's a Genovese capo, and Robert DiBernardo, Gambino capo, who are supplying two of their lieutenants with who have now agreed to let their two lieutenants operate in territory that is split between the Genovese and the Patriarchas. It's Patriarcha territory. They allow the Genovese to work there. So this Paladino, who runs Jerry Angiulo's porn shop, says, hey, they've opened up another store. This is going to cut our business in half. They're making about $3,500, $4,000 a week. They're going to cut our business in half. That's going to be your money cut in half. And I can't pay you the additional $2,000 that I pay you, the VIG that I'm paying you on the loan. So Jerry Angiulo at the time was the underboss for the Genovese. I mean, for the, shit, all these damn SpaghettiO names. Basically, Patriarcha Capo is mad because a Genovese Capo and a Gambino Capo are cutting his business in half. Yeah. This is two New York families reaching into Rhode Island territory and cutting their business in half by setting up a second porn shop.
It's kind of like you give them an inch, they'll take a mile, and which is pretty much the standard operating procedure for these guys.
I can make a damn simple story more complicated. I can stretch some shit out.
Well, it's there's just so much money. It's interesting that they see it as open another store is taking business away, when in fact, what anybody that knows anything about the free market system realizes that you just open up another store, you just create more demand. It's easier to get to for more people, and everybody, rising tide lifts all boats. These mob guys, they never think, doesn't seem like they never think like that. They never think beyond give me mine and don't anybody get involved here.
Yeah, it's a pissing contest, you know. It becomes a sign of disrespect. And, you know, the Paladino, the guy who worked for Angiulo, the Patriarcha boss, he went and talked to this Genovese capo and said, you know, you're getting into our business. And basically the Genovese capo said, you know, get fucked. I don't care. I'm above you. I'm going to do what I want to do. You're just a street guy. Get out of my face. This Paladino goes back and tells Angiulo, I talked to him. He said he's going to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, but that didn't set well with our friend Jerry Angiulo.
Jerry Angiulo was madder than hell. He yelled at his guy for going and talking to another guy on his behalf. He said, you know, what are you talking to somebody in another family? I own you, and you don't talk to anybody without my permission. Second off, he doesn't want to do what he considers it, sharing his revenue. He says he'll split revenue in his store with this guy, with this other capo, because they own it together. But he's not letting him set up another store in his territory without his permit. That's not doing it. He says, well, then I'll get a quarter of the revenue. I'm not doing that. And he considers it disrespect being shown in his territory by both the Gambinos for supplying the porn and the Genoveses for setting up the shop to begin with. So he's got these two interloping families stepping on his territory, showing him disrespect, and for talking to his guy to begin with. He's madder than hell at these families, and at his guy, he's just... Angiulo's an unpleasant guy to begin with. Well, most of these mobsters are not guys you'd have over to Sunday dinner anyway.
Yeah.
So... He's not happy with the situation as it has presented itself.
Wouldn't he have to take this up to Patriarcha to get some kind of resolution? Anything that he did with the other families that became a dispute, he'd have to go to Patriarcha and try to get Patriarcha involved.
That's likely what has happened. Now Angiulo says, we know there was a bug set up in Angiulo's headquarters for a long time. That was based on you know, Bulger had, Whitey Bulger had told the FBI where his headquarters was. The FBI set up a bug there, and it was there for a while. So we have a lot of FBI recordings of what Angiulo said. So Angiulo was yelling at his guy, and he said, "I'm going to go talk to this Sam Cafari, the big boss of the Genoveses in the area, and I'm going to get him straightened out." We know he did that, and he wanted satisfaction. And when that didn't seem to satisfy him, he said he was going to escalate it further. We don't know exactly what happened beyond that point. That was in the beginning of 1981. That was about April or May of 1981. I'm sorry. That was around February of 1981. In April of 81, the Gambino guy supplying the porn, he was arrested on this $3 million porn ring. November of 81, Mastro Totaro, he was involved in a court case targeting organized crime, and he was imprisoned. But the porn shop was closed down in December. There were other people running it, but it was closed down between November and December. Now, it seems to me that the only reason they would close it down is because somebody had ordered it to be closed. I mean, there were other people who could have run it. And, you know, these guys go to jail all the time, and their businesses don't close down, and their men don't just shut down shop. I mean, they run business from prison all the time. And this guy was only in prison for 18 months. He didn't just give up all his rackets. So the evidence seems to point to this, some sort of meeting occurred, probably with Patriarca and the higher ups in the families, and the shop was closed down, and that's
so sounds like Angiulo. Yeah. Sounds like
Angiulo got his way.
He got his way. Probably he got his way. Probably only because of Patriarca and the respect that he had and the fear of him that they had.
Yeah, it was overall it was Patriarca territory. And I think that the Genoveses were making so much other money that one little porn shop was not, in as much as it generated good revenue, it was not worth jeopardizing everything else that they had in the area. It was not worth the kind of conflict that it was going to bring. Angiulo had a hell of a temper, and so did Patriarca, and it was worth maintaining good relations in what was basically Patriarca territory. And which goes to what we were talking about before with the Patriarchas existing on their own. The Genoveses understood that, and they operated in Patriarca territory under Patriarca rules. They closed down this porn shop because they were told they had to. It seems to me, obviously, we don't have any evidence except that it did close down.
Yeah, well, proof's in the pudding, as they say. I would say probably they did. Paul Castellano was the head of the Gambino family at that point in time, and he was a guy. He wasn't really a street guy. He was a guy that would want to make a deal and weigh the the risk and the reward of anything that you did. That's always interesting to if you can ever get wiretaps on him and or bugs and hear him weighing the risk and reward. Now, the lower end guys, they don't think about the risk. They only think about the reward. The bosses will think about the risk.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and there seems to be a divide between, you know, guys who are more street guys and guys who are more business guys. And this DiBernardo was more of the head Gambino porn guy was more of a business guy. And, he was later killed by Gotti in, Sammy the Bull Gravano,
and Sammy's people.
Like you said, Paul Castellano was more of a business guy, and he made a lot of decisions on the long-term business aspects. It doesn't mean that they're not rough and tumble and willing to make executive decisions on whether or not somebody's going to live, but they have the long-term thinking. Probably a lot like Civella. Nick Civella versus Carl.
His brother Carl, yeah. That's part of this movie I'm working on. That we're seeing a lot of that Carl was more or less go out and kill them all. And a guy that was a friend of his, I got one, here's a classic statement that was on a wiretap, or actually it was in a hidden microphone. They're talking about getting this other guy who has people around him, and Willie Camisano was Carl Savella's good friend. And Carl's telling Nick, he said, well, Willie said that we got to take off the limbs before we can get to the trunk. And what he meant was kill off all the guys, you know, friends and people in his organization, and then we'll get to him. So that was his kind of thinking. Nick was more, you know, can't we make a deal? Here's what Nick did. Is another typical sophisticated kind of way, Machiavellian way he might, one of these bosses like Patriarca might work, is these Spiro brothers were mad at him, and they floated a rumor out there that their oldest brother was killed by an old fall partner of his who had just gotten killed himself. And so, well, how convenient, you know. Curly Mintz does some time after doing a job with Nick Spiro. Nick Spiro gets killed, and then Curly Mintz a few years later gets killed, and then they float out the rumor, well, Curly Mintz is the one that killed Nick, and so you guys, it wasn't us. We took care of, him.
Water under the bridge. We took care of Curly Mintz for you, Nick. All good.
Yeah, it's all good now. Didn't work, but you know, that's what I love about these guys is they're not just, you know, you got the hammer and the mallets out there, the sledgehammers, but you got the scalpels out there too, and the scalpels are what makes it fun to learn about and work on.
Yeah, I like that. I like that hammer and scalpel.
Interesting. All right, Cam, it's been a heck of a story. I guess DiBernardo ended up getting killed.
Yep.
Internet came in and pretty much did away with the local porn business. The mob guys, then they had to get more sophisticated and figure out how to get on the internet and control that. And there's no way you're going to control the internet when like some little young guy, 20-some-year-old guy here in Kansas City can jump on a website that's owned by somebody in another country and film some stuff and provide people for live sex acts and that kind of thing on the internet and make $20,000 in a month. You know, they can't control that. There's no way they can control that.
No.
So the end of the, I have to talk to Red Wimette about the end of the porn business one of these days. He probably has some thoughts on that.
Yeah. I think that, you know, mob guys have done some trading schemes on, you know, with the market and different things online, but they don't have the sophistication to do too much,
not to control it like they like to do and like they were doing back then. They wanted to control it. We had a guy in Kansas City who really stayed way back, and a guy named Morris Klein. He had been a gambler and been involved with the mob, a Jewish guy, but he'd been really close in with Nick Savella for a long time. And then he kind of backed off, and you just never saw him anywhere. But eventually we find out that he's all involved in porn. But really was, you know, there were some porn shops in Kansas City. It was more, you know, outside of Kansas City. And we had one little crew, a couple of guys, got into it trying to gather information. And they'd get the books and the movies and bring them in and then write down the specific acts that they would might be pornographic. Oh, it was a filthy business. and you know, nobody really gave a shit about it in the end. So no cases ever came out of it. I think nobody really cared.
It's not hurting any. What people do in the comfort of their confines of their own bedroom. Home. Yeah, right? Really.
Now, mob guys were making money off of that, kind of makes it worthwhile to go after, because then they turn around and use that money to bribe people and do other things with. So that's the only reason it would be worth it.
Yeah.
They were too removed from it here in Kansas City. They were hooked up. They were connected to it. They were getting money off of it. They were pretty far removed. That's another thing about Nick Savella. Any kind of business that was dirty, narcotics or pornography or prostitution, anything like that, he never got involved at all. I mean, he wasn't above ordering a murder, wasn't above doing one himself, but he liked to stick with gambling and fencing and loan sharking and those kinds of activities and providing services to people that they wanted and that just weren't so dirty, shall we say.
Oh, he was just a... Just a simple guy who owned a meat market, wasn't he?
Just a very simple man, you're right. Partners in a meat market with Al Brandemeyer. All right, well, this has been a good show, Cam. I appreciate it. And folks, if you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Now, if you are interested in the Kansas City crime family, you need to rent my movie on Amazon, Gangland Wire. It tells the story, the backstory behind the movie Casino, the story of how the Kansas City, Chicago, Cleveland, and Milwaukee mobs conspired to skim really millions of dollars over the years from several casinos in Las Vegas. Also have the Kansas City Mob Tour app. You can take a mob tour of Kansas City with pictures and maps and text and videos, and I think it's even linked up to my podcast from anywhere in the United States or anywhere in the world with a simple little app off the Apple Store. I have the podcast. Let's see, what else do I have? Don't have something else I'm selling, Cam.
Got your documentary you're working on.
I'm working on this documentary. That'll be out here within about, I got to have it done by November. We're going to do a
film festival
in November again, and I want to have a new movie for it. My partner in that, Terrence, he has in his possession a old VHS tape from the 70s by a guy that was under a murder contract and had left town. He snuck back into town, and he and a friend of his took the old VHS camcorder and drove around and held the, took pictures or shot video of different places in Kansas City. And he talked about different crimes that had happened in different places and who had done them. And there was no real big reveals, but it's interesting stuff. So we're going to show that one, and I'm going to have my movie ready to go and probably get Bill Owsley to come over and maybe do a talk or something. And then a year from now, in June, we're going to have the Mob Summit 2020. We've had one in 2018 in Las Vegas. We had one in 2019 in Hot Springs at the Gangster Museum down there. And I've been talking with Larry Henry, my friend from Fayetteville, who was originally a Las Vegas newsman. And he wants to have it in Kansas City, and I'm on board with it. So I've been working on that. More details will be revealed about that. I'm just starting to take a look at it and see how much money it's going to cost. That's the main thing, is how much money is it going to cost. All right. You got any parting words of wisdom here, Cam?
No, there's not as much money in porn as there used to be. So, listeners need to keep that in mind as far as career options. But I had a great time. And as always, Gary, thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Cam. Good night. Good night, folks.
Music provided by our good friend and superfan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.